Blog Talk Radio. Blog Talk Radio.
It's time to strap our boots on. This is the perfect day to die. Wipe the blood out of our eyes. In this life there's no surrender, and there's nothing left for us to do. Find the strength to see this through. We are the ones who will never be broken. With our final breath, we'll fight to the death. We are soldiers, we are soldiers.
Conversation, and I'd like to thank you if you have just came from my friend Charlotte Dively's show, Prophetic Art Class, and if you enjoy Christian art, then you would really enjoy her show. Just tell you real quick how you could get to her show. Her show you can find on Facebook. You go to the search engine, and you just put in Newt now as one word, N-E-W-T, N-O-W,
really cool.
And you'd just be a few clicks away from being able to find her show. And that is on from 7 p.m. to 8 p.m. Eastern Time. So if you enjoy Christian art, you would really enjoy her show. Now, tonight we have a special guest, Arlen Williams, from Gulag Bound. Now, he is the founder and executive director of the Sovereignty Campaign, SOVCAM.org, an organization of America's sovereignty citizenry that vets and rates candidates to Congress and the presidency on America's core issues of popular and national sovereignty, which are so severely under attack at this moment. He has also founded and coordinates the publishing of the webzine Gulag Bound. Now, one of the things that I have said about the liberals and the Democrats and their handling of the environmental movement is that they have, in some sense, hijacked the movement in order to propagandize the redistribution of wealth agenda. Now, I have here some excerpts from Tom DeWeese, Agenda 21, an international redistribution of wealth. And I have a series of clips here from that speech. And then after I play these for about 11 minutes, we will welcome Arlene Williams. Arlene Williams, to speak of Agenda 21.
Agenda 21 is making its way into American policy in a much more subtle and difficult to follow path. Let me try to explain it. The term sustainable development was born on the pages of the UN's document called Our Common Future, the official report of the 1987 UN World Commission on Environment and Development. As a result of this report, for the first time, the use of environmental protection and human development were tied to the age-old socialist goals of international redistribution of wealth. And that is the key to understanding the true purpose of sustainable development and all of its policies, control of all facets of the economy. Here's how the UN described Agenda 21 in one of its own publications in 1993 in an article entitled Agenda 21, the First Summit, the Earth Summit Strategy to Save Our Planet. It says, quote, Agenda 21 proposes an array of actions which are intended to be implemented by every person on Earth. It calls for specific changes in the activities of all people. Effective execution of Agenda 21 will require a profound reorientation of all humans unlike anything the world has ever experienced. I've never heard a more incredible definition of government. Here is the exact course that brought Agenda 21 to America and into our local communities. The infrastructure pushing the sustainable development agenda is a vast international matrix, and at the top of the heap is the United Nations Environmental Program, the UNEP. But the UNEP doesn't operate on its own. Influencing it are thousands of non-governmental organizations, NGOs. This is the key. These are private groups which seek to implement a special political agenda, and through the UN infrastructure, particularly through the UNEP, they have great power.
Okay, folks, I have another series of clips, but I do see that I have Mr. Williams here on in the switchboard, and I shall let him in. And if he'd like me to continue, that is fine. If not, we'll go ahead and give him the floor as soon as he comes in. Okay.
Hello, Robert?
Yes. It took a little bit for it to load up here on the computer. Hello, Arnold. Thank you for very much for coming in tonight.
Got a little Black Talk Radio. How you doing, Robert?
I'm great. How are you? Thank you for coming to the show. Yes, yeah. I'm sure you're very familiar with the clip I just played. And I have a couple more, but I figured since you're already on the line, I'll go ahead and hand you the floor.
Well, very good. I'm not very good at house cleaning, but I'll see what I can do with that floor for a moment. I appreciate the opportunity to chat with you and your peeps here. Agenda 21 is I don't know, people hear a lot of different things about it, and some of that has been distortion, but a glaring amount of that has been accurate, as Tom DeWeese's clip just mentioned, that it's a it's not really an environmental movement. That's a front. You know, when I grew up in the 60s, we would hear about communist fronts by the Soviets, especially, or the Chinese, and they would be operating some political endeavor or some diplomatic work, and that ability that they've developed to run phony operations is a part and parcel to being a subversive revolution, which they've always been, a worldwide subversive revolution, and they've never gotten worse at it. They've continued to get better at it. And in the days since World War II, they've also gotten better and better at making amends with what should be their natural cousins, their or bastard children, the way anyway you want to look at it, and that's the fascists of Europe and in the world. They've had a good time working on plans like the Rio Accords of 1992, and it's been my privilege, Robert, to talk to a lot of expert people. I'm not an expert myself, but I glean stuff from people, and that's, I guess, a function of being an editor, as I do that with Teresa Monroe Hamilton at Gulag Bound. And when you hear one expert after another and one aspect of another after another, it tends to give you a big picture, and I'd be happy to help portray that as we go tonight. I don't want to get in the way of your plans, though, for your clips, and I'd be happy to let you go on with that if you prefer.
Okay, great. Yeah, I'd like to play this, but also, if you don't mind, Arlen, he was on the line. Who I did have on the line was another great Blog Talk Radio show host, and that was Samuel Samford. He has a Blog Talk Radio show himself called Constitutional Conservatives Unite, and his show is on from 10 p.m. till midnight Eastern time. He was on the line. He was going to mention, I think he was going to talk about briefly, he actually got to meet Newt Gingrich today, but he looks like he's off the line. He maybe had to run something else. Oh. But anyway, I'll go ahead and play those, and perhaps maybe I'll play one, and then Arlen, if you'd like to make comment on what we heard, and then we'll go from there. How's that sound?
That sounds good.
Okay, great. Well, here we go. And normally the longest clip is about 5 minutes, and the one's like three, and one's only like 30 seconds. So I'll go with the second one.
Okay.
So, what is sustainable development? Sustainable development is about a planned central economy and redistribution of wealth on a local, state, national, and international level. The process by which it is implemented creates a matrix of locked away land or severe land use controls, control of energy and energy production, control of transportation, control of industry, control of food production, control of development, control of water availability, and control of population size and growth. Most of their policies and regulations are issued under the excuse of protecting the environment. This is the process through which America is being transformed. It is what local authorities are really doing when they're using terms like comprehensive development plans and energy audits and open space and historic preservation. That is Agenda 21 and sustainable development. And Agenda 21 is not just policy. It is a complete system to change the way we think, the way we react, the way we make decisions, and those who promote it have very specific answers as to how they want you to do each of these things. That's why they call it an agenda. One of the main focuses of Agenda 21 is something called social equity. And I'll tell you right now, if you fail to recognize and understand the social equity aspect of Agenda 21, then you have no grasp of this issue. Social equity is based on a demand for social justice. You hear this term day in and day out now. Social justice is described as the right and opportunity of all people to benefit equally from the resources afforded us by society and the environment. That is a nice way of saying redistribution of wealth. And by the way, Karl Marx was the first to coin the phrase social justice. The sustainable system is based on the principle that individuals must give up selfish wants for the needs of the common good or the community. You will hear the word community used throughout sustainableist literature. According to the sustainableists, it is a social injustice for some to have prosperity if others do not. Profits are made at the expense of the people. This becomes a great threat to property owners and business owners as they are targeted by government policy based on social justice. That becomes a government that does not recognize property owners.
Okay, Arlen, if you'd like to excuse me, chime in on what you just heard. I see another caller, one with a phone number and the other one with your name. Is that both you, Arlen?
Yes, I'm not sure if you're hearing me with an echo, but if you here, let me try it.
No, I'm hearing you fine, but let me check the chat and see if anyone's saying anything about an echo. Let me ask them in chat. Okay, let's see. I ask people in the chat if they're hearing an echo. I don't hear one. You sound great to me. It says you were fuzzy before, Arlen. I'll ask her if it's fuzzy now. See, that's what I really like about the Blog Talk Radio. It's really interactive.
Yes, indeed. It's also informal.
Okay, I've heard someone say no. Okay, so I think we're good.
I think we're good.
Not now. Great. That's great.
Okay.
So go ahead, Arlen. If you'd like to speak on, you know, what we just heard there about the social justice aspect, or so-called social justice aspect of Agenda 21.
Yes, you're going to want to cover the issue, and then I think you're going to also want to talk about the difference between that and what maybe called the conservationism.
Okay, now I can barely hear you. Let me try this other one. There you go. Try that one.
Are we doing okay now?
Oh, that's much better, yes.
Okay. Okay, great. And so, yeah, eager to cover all of that. I guess we could even skip ahead, since we're talking about social justice. Maybe I'll skip ahead and then go back again. But they just had the 20th anniversary Rio conference back in June, last month. Rio Plus 20, it was called. And I got to hear a report about that by way of the good old John Birch folks, the New American, and Lord Christopher Monckton, and he gave a full report about that, and they're actually in inner circle meetings in the Agenda 21 planning cabal. They're having to talk about backtracking on climate change and backtracking on, obviously, global warming and environmentalism. Because it was devised as what has been referred to as soft warfare or Velvet Revolution style warfare on a free society, and we can get into how we know that. But it's been losing that soft war because that soft war is played in the court of public opinion, and public opinion is being swayed more and more by a sound epistemology based on the facts, the scientific facts that are actually gathered that are debunking a major greenhouse effect caused by man-made carbon molecules put in the atmosphere. And so they're having a dickens of a time. They failed to set up about 2 years ago the Copenhagen Accords, and the Cancun conference was held shortly after that, to try to adopt yet another UN program that would supersede Agenda 21 and would actually be a plan for global government. And the word government was the hard word, as opposed to the hide-behind word of global governance was actually in there. Government was in there a couple times. And it was set up with global taxes, with taxes on nations, with a hierarchical central planning system to rein in industry and to really defeat the industrialized Western nations and transfer their wealth, as Tom Dewey said, to the poor, quote unquote, through the United Nations. And those conferences did not result in the adoption of those accords because of numerous reasons. Some of the third world countries just didn't like the results because it just wasn't giving them their means of growth. I mean, they're not fools in the smaller countries of the world, in the less developed countries. They wanted a better situation for them, whether it was by hook or crook or by actual free market principles. And largely that, certainly not Barack Obama, the Obama administration pushed that very, very hard. He went essentially on an emergency trip to Copenhagen. You might remember that in 2009. To get that adopted, and it just failed miserably. It's one of the obvious failures of his own attempts of creating what he was trying to do to fundamentally transform America.
Right.
And so back to Rio plus 20 in June, they were scratching their heads, and this huge meeting turned out to be maybe about a fourth or a fifth of the attendance even that they were planning on, and essentially, it was just a lot of shucking and jiving, and the internal meetings that they were actually able to put plants into, the good guys were able to do that. They heard the guys, you know, scratching heads and moaning about not being able to really sell environmentalism like they thought they'd be able to. You know, the Chicago Climate Change Exchange was shot down. And the cap and trade, the major cap and trade, was shot down. They're still trying to do that quietly and in various ways to create an quote unquote energy exchange based trading system. But they're not succeeding in the rapidity that they needed to. You know, Maurice Strong, the founder of Agenda 21, or like the front man for it. Was you know, he's about 81, just like George Soros and Mikhail Gorbachev are. He was just almost panicked in an interview or two that we were able to see before all this happened. That it, you know, the goals had to be adopted for global managed climate change through Agenda 21. And you know, he must be a very disappointed man right now because it just didn't get done, and they're having to move back to. What they're going to do then is they just fold it in to their other themes, and instead of climate change, they're going to be talking more about what actually is an important subject, and I'm sure you agree about that, is biodiversity and the need to protect the species and prevent extinctions. And they're going to fold that in. They're also going to, as we've talked about, and increasingly they're folding in just the raw redistributive principle of quote-unquote social justice, doing it in a number of ways, and we can get into how they're doing it too, but they're not having a good time. So we're going to still be hearing about Agenda 21. We can describe how it's being implemented in the United States and around the world, but it's being fought back. And, you know, the way to clear cockroaches out of a restaurant in New Orleans is by turning the lights on, and then you can start cleaning them out too, the ones that remain, and that's exactly what has begun to happen. So that's the good news. That's the good news. So I've talked enough. What do you have for another question?
Well, as I said, I'll play these series of clips, okay. And we can answer on them. And then I definitely want to segue. You know, point tonight is one thing that, you know, I'm pushing for. Is what? Let me give a little description first. What it sounds like to me through Agenda 21 is I believe Agenda 21 is definitely a top-down approach.
Yes.
And what I would like to see, because I do consider myself an environmentalist, and that's why I do these shows. I do have strong notions on environmental protection and conservation. But I think the way to have it done, in the way that would give people, individuals, the most freedom, the most liberty, is by addressing environmental protection, conservation, in a top down, like a grassroots way, towards sustainability. Which, as I said, saying is, it gives people the most freedom and it gives them the most liberty to pick the ways that best works for them, okay, that would protect the environment. Now, one of those such ways is, you know, through business, through entrepreneurship, you know, things of that nature, markets, much like, you know, what Newt Gingrich has described, you know, with his green conservatism. I'm not the one who coined that phrase, Newt Gingrich did, and that's something later on this evening I'd like to touch
sure.
upon after we, you know, we talk more, or you talk more about, you know, what you know about Agenda 21. So that's where I'd like to get, you know, at some point of the conversation tonight to address that. And also, since it is a, you know, political show, I want to talk about the political ramifications on Mitt Romney and where he is believed to stand on Agenda 21. And I have an article here, it's a short one, it's not even an article, it's just like a dossier of Mitt Romney by a site here, it's Conservative Liberty Alliance, and it's their candidate review,
mm-hmm.
and they're talking about Mitt Romney, and I've got a few things I'll read from there later. So getting back to, I guess, the format that I created for today, this is just a 36-second clip that I picked up off the 24-minute, you know, you know, whole movie that I watched. It's not a movie, but, you know, that I watched today, and there might not even be enough here to make comment on, but I obviously thought it was worth, you know, taking out of that the larger clip and making this one.
Let's check it out.
By the way, the fact is, Agenda 21 is a blueprint to completely change our society to a top-down, planned central economy and a strange mixture of socialism, fascism, and corporatism. And so, federal and state governments working hand in hand with a horde of non-governmental organizations, private groups with personal political agendas, force passage of rules and regulations passed down to local communities. Everything connected to sustainable development translates to higher costs, shortages.
Okay, that's why I thought that clip. It talks, brings up about it being a top-down approach. So I guess it was supposed to be my segue, and I segued into that clip instead. It's funny
right.
how that worked out.
You want to talk top-down? Let's talk top-down.
Yeah.
Why don't we talk? Why don't we take two deep breaths and try to give a history of this whole thing to some degree?
Okay, that's excellent.
Way back, long ago, in the 1700s, we had two kinds of revolutions happening. One was the American Revolution, which was all about the ability, the notion that we got from the Bible that said that we're created in God's image and we're created to have dominion over the earth and that we're supposed to be free to carry out what our natural inclinations are so long as they're virtuous and that we're supposed to have stewardship over the land and stewardship over the earth and care for each other and to the best extent possible, do that naturally without the intervention of law and government. Then, they're also way back in Europe, in the French Revolution, at the same, just roughly the same time, was a nasty revolution that was all about, oh, those rich people, those aristocrats and nobility that are hoarding the money, we're going to go after them. And, you know, they're hiring us and firing us. They're controlling our lives. They're keeping us in impoverished situations. We're going to take their wealth and chop their heads off. And then we're going to make things equal among everybody. And by the way, while we make things equal, we're going to make sure that the people that are doing it and are in control are more equal than others, as George Orwell later pointed out. And those guys in France happened to be funded by, they're called the Jacobins, and they were like the prototype Marxists, and they happened to be funded by these dudes that you hear about so often, the central bank people, the Rothschild family, that had just gotten their big-time wealth by that time. And lo and behold, they were financing them, and actually in the later end of the French Revolution with Napoleon versus Wellington, they were able to play both sides against the middle, and I won't go into length about that. Got to be huge profiteers about that. So some people talk about the Marxist Revolution and the Marxist worldwide conspiracy. Other people talk about the central banking system and the Rothschilds. And in a really ugly way, sometimes that gets ethnic. That's a bad thing. That should never be an ethnic issue. But the funny fact is they're the same thing. And it's been historically pointed out that the Bavarian, which was the real hot-going thing out of Germany, was definitely associated with the same kind of people that were involved with the Jacobins and they got financed with the same people that are in power in the central banking system right now. So it's never been two conspiracies or competing conspiracies. It's always been the same thing. Those people working together, the money on one side and the guns on the other, as my friend, James Simpson would talk about the Soviet Union, the people with the guns. And so they figured out a way to take advantage of the kind of machinations of manipulating people that get really devious that Niccolò Machiavelli wrote about, and also Sun Tzu in The Art of War. And that's all about, if you can have proxy armies, why fight yourself? If you can get your enemy to fight itself and to collapse by subversive measures, well, that's the best way to win a war. And so they practiced this very well. And lo and behold, they met up with philosophers of the Enlightenment era about the same time, including Arthur Schopenhauer and that German tradition. Everything seems to be coming from Germany in that era. That's nasty. And Arthur Schopenhauer was kind of like, who's that dude again with Nirvana that killed himself?
Kurt Cobain.
Arthur Schopenhauer was like Kurt Cobain of his time. He was all about, oh, this world is such a drag with all this industry, people taking advantage, the 1% taking advantage of the 99%, and it's just getting all morbid, and it's a real drag, and we should really all be about art instead, and obviously there's nothing about God, and we should just all be about music and art and better life through whatever kind of rock and roll Arthur Schopenhauer was into. And so and also in the mix was very much was the Green Movement, and he was kind of like the grandfather, as Mark Musser, a very important researcher and author that we have featured at gulagbound.com, has brought out. He really was the grandfather of the Green Movement philosophically. And that got translated through other German philosophers, including Nietzsche. And the philosopher that was living that Hitler tapped and that actually was a Nazi philosopher king, so to speak, in the Nazi regime, Heidegger. And the Nazis movement was very much a green movement. It was even more green than Karl Marx. It's more of a classic green that you see right now is the kind that they fomented in the Nazi Third Reich movement, if you want to call that a movement. And whereas with Karl Marx, he was more like, let's just live copacetic with the land and live in little rural pockets and communities and all share and everything and not be so industrialized. But the Nazis wanted to have industrialized pockets. And what you see today is that very same goal that with the Agenda 21 goal. Oh, incidentally, they want death in the mix too, just like the Nazis. They want to reduce the population to just maybe 400,000 or 500,000 as Ted Turner would want. 400,000 or 500,000, excuse me, as what Ted Turner would want around
That's
the whole
globally,
earth.
Correct.
Mm-hmm, globally, around the whole earth. God only knows what they would want to do to reduce that, and some of them probably are devising it. And they want otherwise people. They want the land to resume. They want the verdure to come back naturally, and the animals. It's kind of like they would prefer most of the world to be the safari turf that it was so cool to frolic in, because they're the wealthy people that want to control the world and fewer people to control that way.
Well, actually, yeah, I was just going to ask you that question. Do you believe that the people who, are trying to instigate this, it's because the fewer amount of people, as you just pointed out, the easier it would be to control them?
Exactly. I think you see that, too, as a natural, very subtle temptation. When people get more and more wealthy, they take on, you know, maybe they're president of a corporation and they think of the drag it is to have to handle all these people. And they also think how nice it is to vacation in natural lands. Now, you and me, we like to do vacation in natural lands, too. And we would love to go out and hunting and fishing wherever we can and nature walking and things like this. And it's a real drag for us to, you know, go out on a vacation to Lake Superior or whatever river, lake or ocean and see the every shoreline ringed with houses of the rich, of the 1%, or whatever you want to say. That's nasty. And, you know, we've taken measures in the country so that it isn't all that way, so that we do have some natural lakes and forests and parks and shorelines. And there's camping and there's even places where you can, and so some of that is good. Some of that is good, but they want it all as much as possible. And surely, the fewer the people there are, the more there is, the easier it is to control them. Why would you need so many? They're rich already. They don't need people to help give them wealth. They've already got the wealth. They can just live just as well on controlling a fewer people than the masses. It's much easier to do that. Yeah. What is anathema to them is exactly what our country was founded on. The fact that everybody is, you don't have to fight for any equality. Everybody is an ontological equal. We're all equal by nature. There's no one of greater esteem than anyone else. And frankly, of course, the Bible says all have sinned and fallen short of the glory of God and are all miserable sinners without redemption too, but that's another story. We all still are created in God's image and we all deserve respect from each other. And we should all be free. We should all be interchanging with each other. Economic intercourse, as they called it. And adding value to each other. That's the great gift of the real free market system. We add value to each other's lives, and in so doing, we gain our own wealth. And they don't like that. So, boy, I could get off in a few different directions. So the people, the royals don't like that. So the wealthy royals that allied themselves with fascists, as another author in Gulag Bound, William Kay, has brought out, they don't like that. Certainly, hardly anybody in the power in Europe likes that. The Marxists don't like that. The central bankers don't like that. The poor Rothschilds themselves, they were forced to live on a street that was closed off at both ends at curfew time in a really skinny street in Frankfurt. They were really abused by these WASPs of the Reformation in Germany. And so I think they probably got kind of peeved about it and embittered about it. And they figured out a way to work with the royals to gain more and more wealth. And they figured out that eventually they could manipulate that and to, you know, if you get rich enough to provide nations their wealth, and so to speak, and get them dependent on you like a drug addict on the pusher, then you figure out ways to get back at those nasty people in the middle class that were the landholders, the gentry and the business owners, and they're the abusers, and you don't like those. So I think those were, you might say, the prototype limousine liberals that were riding around in horse-drawn limousines at the time, and they're feeding the mix and continuing to this day. And it's just amazing when you see a Marxist like Bill Ayers and friends, that often you can, if you were able to do an honest genealogical study, you would see Marxism and going way back generation after generation after generation to these very same people. They permeated spots in the United States in the early 1800s and middle 1800s. They settled in almost a scattered intelligent fashion. I think it was planned. A lot of them in Chicago and then sweeping up through Wisconsin and Minnesota and out to Iowa and up to Michigan from there. A lot of them in rural areas. A lot of them into California. Anaheim was founded as a literal communist community. And there are plenty of others in California that were founded that way. Texas, too. And, of course, throughout the East. And so it's almost like they were sending missionaries to America, too. And that's why we, in the 1800s on, had that painting of the hopeful goals of the more honest people in the progressive movement. And so, yeah, it is all about top down, isn't it? It's all about control. Nobody should ever think that real Marxism exists as Karl Marx wrote it out, where the end goal is egalitarianism. That is a facade. It always has been and it always will be. What it's always all about is the wealthiest 1% of 1% of 1% of 1%, also being the most powerful, that control the rest of the world and enslave. And the end result is what we see in North Korea. And so, why not do that in a way that preserves the environment? Sure, they're good for that. So, and so let's manipulate that issue and manipulate the dickens out of it. And the people, the altruistic motives of tender-hearted and perhaps tender-brained people in the left and the environmental movement, and they decided to manipulate the dickens out of that. A fellow who lived a few miles from where I live right now, Aldo Leopold, was the great leader of the eco-fascists a few generations ago. He was all about just shacking up in a in his own little laboratory hovel of a cabin in the woods and doing all his work and trying to get everybody to just live in hovels and cabins in the woods. And Mark Musser found out that he, lo and behold, was a real eco-fascist. He went to Nazi Germany and cohabitated with those guys and developed a lot of his philosophy right along with him. He probably met Heidegger. And so he's become the grandfather of the environmental movement in America. And there's a state financed parks and facilities where you can have tours dedicated to Aldo Leopold in Wisconsin.
You said about the government helping. It kind of sounds like, I'm going to paraphrase here, something Ronald Reagan has said is, you know, if you have a government official coming to your door and knocking saying, hello, it's the government, we're here to help you, don't answer.
That's right.
Like that. Well,
you know,
Yeah.
I mean, that's the point. That's the problem with any sort of government run influence into private enterprise. I'm not an ultra, you know, Ayn Rand libertarian on the matter. I believe that government, I'm more of an Adam Smith economist. I believe, as America's founders did and read Adam Smith's Wealth of Nations, that a government has a natural duty to make sure that society is looking out for national interest, which happens to be the interest of the people within the nation that they serve. So obviously it makes sense. And that we do have to do some regulation to make sure that everybody lives right. Because, you know, the most famous Federalist paper and probably the most famous quote from it, I can't quote it completely, but it's Federalist paper number 51 written by James Madison. He said it was about the separation of powers. He lamented, well, if people were angels, we wouldn't need government. But have to have government, and the problem is we can't pick angels to be our government either. So we have to put fallen humanity in the roles of government too. So then you have to figure out how to have checks and balances to keep government minimal and in line. And that's why they had that's why John Roberts sits in the chair of the Chief Justice and is able to pervert it the way he has, because he was there supposedly to thwart laws that would make the government too powerful and one branch more powerful than the next one. Let me quote. Go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, we did have a show here one night about the Justice Roberts, the Justice Roberts decision, and actually people could find that on the archives. Mm-hmm. I think I did a broadcast and possibly even a rebroadcast of that show, but go ahead. You know, so if anyone would like to check that episode out, you can find it in the archive.
Excellent.
For my show. So, but thank you very much. Go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, his famous quote from his ruling on Obamacare is totally a lie. His famous quote is that, to paraphrase it, the judicial branch is not there to keep people from the to prevent the consequences of the people's decisions when they elect people. That's exactly what the judiciary is there for. That's exactly what it's for. It's to be a check on elected officials so that they don't gain too much power over the people, regardless of who is voted in. So he just did a complete hellish 180 when he said that. I was astounded the first time I heard about it. And so that starts to get into the area of, getting into solutions, and I'd like to jump into that as soon as is feasible, but I think there's some more things to flesh out about environmentalism and good and the bad. And what do you think, John? Robert, I almost called you John.
It's okay. what I was going to bring up, and we talked about this a little bit when we talked on the phone, is I do have some people here on the line, and I'm not sure whether they're just listening on or if they had some questions, and I'll leave it fully up to you whether you'd be open for some questions if we had time, if we could do that in another evening when you come in. But what's your thoughts on that? Let them in, and if they have any questions, you can answer any questions they have. Or
I think we're at a point where I think people have a decent idea of Agenda 21. What we haven't talked about is how they're implementing it, and they're continuing to try to implement it in an extra-governmental, para-governmental, quote-unquote public-private partnership method, and we can talk about that. But I'd be happy to talk to a few people if they want to talk to me.
Okay, great. Yeah, definitely. And the more I'm hearing about this Agenda 21 and I hear you talking, I mean, there could definitely be a whole series on this, I'm seeing. But I'm going to go ahead and let some people who've been on hold for a while see what they have to say. If they're just on to listen, that's fine too. But I will start off with the person who, has been on hold the longest. Now, I am going to make this disclaimer. We do not allow foul language here, so if you're in here just to cause trouble, I will instantly click and you'll be gone and you won't be able to come back. And so just talk with respect, and we really appreciate it. Now let this first caller in. Okay, this is 727. Did you come in to ask any questions, or do you just want to, are we just pulling in to listen to it through the phone?
No, thank you. I'm just listening.
Oh, okay. Well, then I'll put you back on hold. Thank you very much for coming to the show tonight. Okay, well, that was just listening. I'm going to go to area code 202. 202, you have any questions, or you just want to listen via the phone also?
Hey, Robert. No, I wanted to chime in. This is Dan.
Oh, hey, Dan. How are you? I don't keep track of people's phone numbers, so that's why I'm like, oh, okay. But go ahead.
Yeah, no, I just wanted to, since tonight is sort of green conservatism night, just say that to Arlen, that I actually used to work at the Department of Energy, and just three doors down from me was a nice man who worked on the UN panel for climate change. And, I wrote a few papers for Harlan Watson, who was George Bush's climate change negotiator. And I infamously put together a presentation one day that just said that anthropogenic climate change is complete nonsense. And I got inspired to do this because I used to work with UK DTI a lot. DTI used to be Department of Trade and Industry, but now it's DEC, the Department of Energy and Climate Change. And so we, DOE and DTI put on this event. Sir David King came, who was science advisor to Tony Blair. And he gave essentially the Al Gore presentation. He didn't have a cherry picker, but believe me, he had some really big monitors. I mean, things were like 8 feet tall, probably 20 feet of monitors behind the guy. And when he showed the thing about CO2, I just like jumped out of my chair. I was like, oh my God, I mean, this is really like, wow. I've been wrong this whole time, And so, Sir David King just convinced me, but I went back to the
department. You were my first hockey sticks, right? Cross check,
yeah,
right?
Yeah,
in the
exactly.
Face.
The hockey stick. The puck from that hockey stick hit me like right between the eyes, So I went back and, I started doing some research and digging into this stuff. And, I got a little deep into it, starting to look at, oxygen 18 versus oxygen 16 isotopes, which are often used as a proxy to tell temperature far back in the past. And, of course, I was at DOE headquarters. So, if I needed any assistance, I could just call any lab and say, hey, I'm in headquarters and I need to know what's going on with this climate change stuff. And, boom, they'd send you more stuff than you could possibly even read. And basically, it's complete nonsense. Every bit of it is complete nonsense. There is no statistical correlation between CO2 in the atmosphere and the temperature of the planet. That's not to say it doesn't have an effect. That's not to say it doesn't act as a multiplier, but there are so many other things going on the planet that actually do determine the temperature on the planet that CO2 is so insignificant. I mean, for, you know, we talked about the greenhouse effect, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so if you go build a greenhouse behind your house, what actually is insulating that greenhouse? Water vapor.
Grass, right? Water, yeah.
The most important greenhouse gas is water vapor. The second most important greenhouse gas is water vapor. The third most important greenhouse gas is water vapor. I mean, the entire thing is just absolutely absurd. And, you know, I put together this PowerPoint presentation that just obliterated everyone. I sent it to the guy who sort of worked on this stuff for us. And he came into my office with kind of a panicked look on his face. He said, look, this is a really good presentation. You should continue to work on this. Meaning he knew, you know, it was his job, so what's he going to do?
Mm-hmm.
Of course, you know, then everybody got wind of it. And, you know, next thing I know, I'm the most hated man in the Department of Energy. But who cares?
Sure.
I was right.
Sure. Sure. You were the Galileo, and the Spanish Inquisition had to get on your case, I'm sure.
Oh, they don't. Once they get on your case, they don't let up. You know, that stuff goes after hours, too. You go out into, I mean, D.C. is a fishbowl. It's a very small city, so there's so many restaurants to go to and that kind of stuff. And, they'll wherever you are, they'll be bugging you. But, you know.
Can we talk after the program, or can you send me an email? When you started to say that of what you were doing and that you were working for this fellow that was the original alchemist with the conical hat working for George H.W. Bush, I got goosebumps. I would really love to talk with you.
Yeah, sure. Robert, if you want to write down my phone number and then give it to Arlen, you can give me a call and we'll chat.
Yeah, we'll get on Facebook and then we'll you know, message back and forth and then I'll get it to him. Yeah, because we're both friends on Facebook.
Okay.
Both of us are, so we can communicate and get phone numbers that way. I don't almost do any phone numbers over the line or anything like that. So we'll do it by Facebook.
Okay.
It's also interesting. Just let me bring this in this parenthetically. We're going to post Christopher Monckton's post Rio 20 plus interview tomorrow morning. One of the things he brought out is he had a good friend, is it Eric Edmondson? Eric something that like that, that was one of the first founders of Greenpeace, and he got to be good friends with this guy. You know, Christopher Monckton is an environmentalist. He is a conservationist. And this guy was lamenting the fact that he got routed out of Greenpeace that he helped principally found by these Marxists, and the way he put it was that, and this complies with research that some of which is known, and some of which is kind of unknown to a lot of people, but closely kept under wraps, that it's just a verifiable fact that the fall of the Soviet Union was a planned event, and it was meant to be a kind of a metastasizing of the cancer. Instead of a breakdown in the system, and that the European nations were still meant to be controlled, and the way this Eric, I don't know if it's Edmondson, something like that, the way he put it was that when the Berlin Walls came down, then they just crawled over the walls, and all of these people, and what he was talking about, these people, they were the KGB. Marxist operatives just took over the green movement all over the world. And
it's kind of interesting you mention that guy because, you know, another coincidence, my girlfriend in D.C. that I used to live with, she he hired a consulting firm, and she was assigned to the case to talk about nuclear power and all this kind of stuff. So she used to work with him fairly closely, and, you know, she told me, yeah, I was talking to him today, and you know, he founded Greenpeace and all this kind of stuff, and now all these people are against him, and she was talking to him, and he said one of the reasons I had to leave Greenpeace is there was this meeting where they were going to ban, the elements. They were going to ban one of the elements, I forget, and he's like, how can we ban an element on the periodic table? You know? Like, this is absolutely absurd. And they, you know, they basically all attacked him and started drumming him out. I've got to look at the periodic table to remember what the element was. But, you know, it's a very famous Greenpeace meeting. He's like, these people are insane, you know. Uh-huh. Like, this is no longer a rational movement. This is something else. And, of course, as you know, the left, they get in, they find a successful organization, they move in by stealth, and then they co-opt it, they take it over, and they turn it into a spam machine for leftist propaganda, and essentially they destroy the host.
Right. Absolutely. That's exactly the way they work. And then in the end, you're left with just vast devastation. You're left with North Korea or Cambodia under Pol Pot. I think, Dan, you will find very interesting an article in Gulag Bound called The Royal Side of the Fascism Behind Agenda 21. It's that title I gave to it, kind of autocratically. It's a book review by William Kay of a book written by an excellent history professor in California. Come on, what's his name? Why don't I have it? His name is Petropoulos, and he chronicled the history of fascism and especially fascism's involvement with the royals of Europe. And lo and behold, I'm reading this nice, just wonderful long book review, and it's just a wonderful piece that William Kay has written, because, you know, it's a really long article that can save you from writing a book or from reading a book. And I'm reading how, lo and behold, and I come the current consort to the Queen of England, Prince Philip, it was a Nazi and cohabitated with the Nazis. And of course, who's this down there? Was his name Edward, the guy that abdicated? It wasn't because he had an American fiance. It was because he was a fascist, and that wouldn't have been a cool thing to have for a fascist president king in during World War II. And so there's this picture even of Philip walking in this parade. Of a funeral of a cousin of his, or an uncle, I guess, who was a Nazi, married to the Nazis of Germany. And of course, that got to me thinking, well, lo and behold, where did George H.W. Bush sign the Rio Accords? It was on the yacht of Prince Philip's oldest son, Charles.
Whoa.
Yeah. And of course, we have in the Bush family, we have dad, granddad, you know, we have George Herbert Walker's father, Prescott Bush, who documented evidence has just clearly pinned him as a Nazi collaborator, financier of America. And isn't that something?
Yeah. I'm going to chime in about and bring something to, you know, current events going on. And one of the things that at least I in this show and the people I've been, you know, connected with, are, you know, things we're trying to do, and it does have relevance to Agenda 21. So go ahead, Dan.
Yeah, absolutely. I just wanted to make a quick point that, you know, people forget that fascism was all the rage in the 20s and 30s. Fascism was the wave of the future. And there were all these people who were fascists who now, you know, completely disavow that they ever were. But, you know, and I got criticism. I took modern Chinese history, right? And so the guy who was teaching it was from Taiwan. And, you know, so I'm reading about fascism versus communism, all this kind of stuff, which after you had the American Revolution was the highest expression of the Enlightenment, you know, in my mind, you know, sort of individual liberty, the end of the age of absolutism, and now, you know, it's all about the free man, classical liberalism, free people, free markets, you know, determining their own future, working for their own self-interest to promote the common good, right?
Right.
Well, then you've got sort of the socialist model coming out of Karl Marx and Lenin and all that kind of stuff, right? So the socialism stuff got caught up. Well, you know, one strand of socialism would bind with nationalism to become, you know, Nazism or whatever, and fascism. But, you know, like, if you look at Chiang Kai-shek, he always appears in a military uniform. And every picture I saw, look, he's always in a military uniform. So I asked the guy, I said, you know, I'm just curious, because Chiang Kai-shek always appears in a military uniform. Was he a fascist? And he was like totally offended at the question. He reduced my grade from an A to a B because of that. But, he was an ally of ours. Look at Stalin. He always appears in military uniform, all this kind of stuff. I mean, fascism really was, back then, the wave of the future. Now, you know, Hitler, of course, completely discredited that ideology and, you know, good riddance to that guy. But, you know, communism hung around, which essentially is the same. It's the same thing, but the only difference between communism and Nazism or fascism is that communism is like trans-border. It's about international communism, which essentially is international fascism.
Right.
Whereas fascism is a nationalist variant of essentially communism.
And that's where exactly we are. Where we are, and Agenda 21 is perhaps the best model for demonstrating all of that of how it all comes together. And there's very little difference in the governance of communist China right now, and Russia, and Brazil, and the European nations, and Barack Obama's America. It's all exactly what we're talking about more and more. It's fascism. On a global scale, it's global fascism. And by fascism, if anybody's listening out there and you think that means that you hate Jews and you march with a goose step, that's not what it means. It means that you believe in government controlling a kind of an artificial ersatz private enterprise, and you do it ministerially according to slices. Obama has all his czars. And that got started with the Nixon administration, by the way, and metastasizing with Obama. And you've got ministerial control of society. They did it originally through the guilds and trade councils. Oh my goodness, trade councils. That's interesting. NAFTA, GATT, North American Trade Council, That's fascism, okay? It's also called corporatism, and it's also called crony capitalism by Sarah Palin, and it's just tyranny. And that's what difference is there, Dan and Robert, between that and the madness of King George that we fought an American Revolution to be free of? It's the same thing.
Yeah, and one thing what I like to do, guys, and this fan from being on the show, is I like to go to the chat sometimes and make some comments and answer some questions in there. And one thing I think is a good segue for where I want to go next, or at least move into where I want to go next, is someone mentioned that Mitt, and I'm sort of talking about Mitt Romney, is a corporatist. Now, I was doing a little research today, and there's a website of Conservative Liberty Alliance Candidate Review. And I looked at what they had to say about Mitt Romney. What I wanted to do is, I was doing some research on what Mitt Romney feels or thinks on Agenda 21. And what I found here is what the CLA, what they view as national sovereignty. And what they have to say about national sovereignty is that the CLA supports aggressive measures to stop all United Nations efforts on its one world movement called Agenda 21. And believe a candidate must declare UN Agenda 21 illegal for the adoption in the USA. We also support English being established as the official language of the United States, that voter fraud must be dealt with, prevent the infiltration of foreign law, including Sharia law, in which judges might be used to subvert the Constitution or the will of the people of the United States, and stop judges/justices legislation from the bench. Now, I'm guessing they had a questionnaire that they gave Romney or his campaign or what have you, and it says, Romney supports English as the official language of USA, does not believe Sharia law is an issue because we have a law and constitution, and will not support or not appoint judges who legislate from the bench. Now, we're talking about Agenda 21 this evening, and we just heard what the CLA supports and aggressive measures to stop. Is there anything missing from what Romney is going to do or says he's going to do?
There's a black hole there, and unfortunately there's a past. Everything that Mitt Romney did in Massachusetts, virtually everything, was the kind of thing that we're talking about. It was public-private partnerships on a liberal flavor, and it's very hard to do public-private partnerships on anything but the left. There's only one direction to go from freedom, but we can talk about that later. But he implemented the Massachusetts Environmental Plan in, I think, 2004. Yeah, and it's Agenda 21. So just as he is the testbed implementer of Obamacare in Massachusetts, he is the testbed implementer of Agenda 21 in Massachusetts. And he needs to be put on the spot. That's one thing we want to do with the sovereignty campaign, with the presidential candidates, if at all possible, if they'll listen to, you know, us lowly capital P people that are sovereign of the United States of America, that rule over our elected officials. If they'll listen, we'll pose those questions to him. And of course, we want to do that with the sovereignty campaign through all of Congress, if possible, at least through all of the Senate, because the Senate ratifies treaties, and then at least in the closely held congressional races. But boy, there's Mitt Romney again, and he needs to be put on the spot.
Well, you know, one thing about Mitt Romney in his past, look, Mitt Romney said that he voted for Paul Tsongas in 1992. Now, I don't know about you, but I don't know a lot of Republicans who are voting Tsongas in 92. It seems like an odd choice. And the first time he shows up with an R near his name is when he's running for Senate in 1994 against Ted Kennedy. Mm-hmm. So why would he run as a Republican? Because it's Ted Kennedy. And there's a political machine in place in Massachusetts that cranks out Kennedy Kerry every 6 years, right? And so he couldn't run as a Democrat. And so, like Michael Bloomberg, he switched from the Democrat Party to become a Republican. And he has consistently, throughout his career, run against everything that we as Republicans and as conservatives have been trying to put in place in this country. So the Republican Party is just a means to an end for him. He's not a Republican. Deep down, he's a progressive. And he self-proclaimed progressive. And this is, you know, one of the things that's maddening to me. The Republican Party leadership itself is treating, I'm a Newt Gingrich supporter, but the Republican Party is treating like these Ron Paul people as if they're some kind of third party, you know, or something, and they're not real Republicans. When Ron Paul has been with the Republican Party since the 70s, Mitt Romney is third party. And so that's why I keep telling everybody, quit voting third party. You know, vote for Republicans, not for this third party.
Dan, and the conclusion that the Conservative Liberty Alliance candidate review got of Mitt Romney was at the end they have, you know, the CLA concerns, and we bring up, you know, conservatism, because I said that the show's, you know, title is Bring Conservatism, and conservatism at its core, is that the CLA concerns about Romney is he supports big government solutions to health care and opposes pro-growth tax code reform, broke state law and ordered his town clerks to issue marriage licenses to same-sex couples in 2004, in contravention to Massachusetts state law and under threat of termination, does not believe Sharia law is an issue because we have a law and constitution, and this is the point that's more in line with tonight's discussion, is aligned to globalization and sustainable development, and that's not, I'm going to put this little thing in there, that's not green conservatism, sustained development isn't, has a record of changing positions to different groups, pro-life to pro-choice, advocate for gays and their rights to opposition to gay marriage and civil unions, and support of gun control measures to becoming a card-carrying NRA member, and supports No Child Left Behind. And that was kind of their conclusion about Mitt Romney. And that was the conservative Liberty Alliance.
Well, not to mention, when Mitt Romney left the governorship, he destroyed all records of anything that occurred while he was governor of Massachusetts. Now, let me tell you something. When I was with the Department of Energy, everybody deleted their emails immediately. They would read it, and they would delete it immediately, except me. I, when all of this stuff kind of blew up with me, my presentation, and, you know, oh, my God, what am I doing, like bringing truth and facts to the table and not going along with the program, you know, someone, a friend of mine, came up to me and he said, look, I read an email, I delete it, because then they could get it. You have to delete every email you get. You read it, you delete it right away. And so I turned to him and I said, you know, hey, I have every single email I've ever received since I started working here. And his eyes were just like as big as moon pies, like, holy crap. And then I got into a meeting where they started trying to pin some junk on me, you know, oh, you know, this guy, Dan, he's a big problem right here. And so I pulled out an email from 2001. Remember this one? March 14th. You said, and I read it, he was like, you know, and just the guy was destroyed. You know, it's just, okay, well, that's over. And then they had to go talk to him, you know. But, you know, I think it says in the Bible, the truth will set you free. But a guy who destroys all records when he was governor, something was going on. Because I've been in that environment before. Something untoward was going on when he was governor.
Yeah, well, another big clue about that is Barbara Bush, who, you know, gets on the Fox News programs and praises Georgie because he's the son of George Romney, who was, you know, just like peas in a pod with George H.W. Bush, helping to create the Thousand Points of Light Foundation and involved in mutual pursuits left and right, and that's not really a good history as is getting out more and more. A bunch of people on the left have been hurling stuff up about rumors about the Bush family for years and years, and unfortunately, there's a kernel of truth in it. And there is a connotation even with the Thousand Points of Light and the New Age movement, which is closely tied into this globalist movement. And of course, Skull and Bones is a big factor with that too, which has also got its direct German brother, so to speak, in the Thule Society of Germany. And it's very problematic in terms of what happens with those entities and what's been recorded of them and so on. There's just a lot of problem there. And we have a couple articles that address that I think you'd be very interested in reading. If you would go to Gulag, if you'd put in your web search engine, gulagbound.com, and the name of Carol Quigley, K-A-R-R-O-L-L, Quigley, Q-U-I-G-L-E-Y. You have a gentleman that is a pronounced globalist that's in the system financed by the financiers, and he brags about how they're controlling the two-party system and playing one end against the other, and so that it all goes under control. And that very much complies with the methodology that Glenn Beck has popularized with the Overton window principle. So if you get a guy like Barack Obama in there who pulls the Overton window way, 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 way over to the left, and that's what he's been doing. He's been doing two things. He's been sabotaging the economy on purpose in cahoots with George Soros, who, by the way, got his money just as Maurice Strong, the father of Agenda 21, did. He got it from the Rothschilds. That's documented. And Arnold de Borgrave features that in an article that we feature at gulagbound.com. It's another search if you want to do a web search on ARNAUD and Soros and Rothschild and gulagbound.com. You'll find that article.
Can you pronounce real quick, because I saw this recently and I did not have time to look into it, but I saw that there was, you know, the House of Morgenthau and the House of Rothschild, they were not friends for a long time, but I read they recently entered into some sort of agreement. Are you aware of that? And what is
No, but I'm not surprised. I think there are kind of factions of the Rothschild complex too, and some of them are not so keen on communists. And some are, that doesn't surprise me. Everybody's getting along together, it seems, that's on the left, because that's the way they work. I mean, that's kind of like sharks. They smell the blood in the water, so they all go to the blood, and eventually when they come up and the corpse is dead, they'll start fighting each other again. That's when the purges, You know, the purges always come after the revolution, but they all seem to get along before the revolution. That's how it happened in the French Revolution. That's how it happened in the Russian Revolution. You know, they got rid of the Tsar, and then the white and green and red Russians started to fight each other.
Well,
absolutely.
Well, one person that I believe that, you know, at least the people, you know, who listen to me regularly know one candidate that is not for Agenda 21, from my understanding, but said if he was to become president, and one of the things we're hoping for is that we do indeed get a brokered convention, because we'd really like to see someone other than Mitt Romney becoming the nominee, because we just don't, you know, at least the people I talk with and myself personally, don't believe that Mitt Romney has a chance of beating Barack Obama. For one, that because of his record truly doesn't show that he, you know, he has a conservative record. But one person, I'd like to play a short clip here of the gentleman that I'm sure we're all aware I'm speaking of, but I'm going to play it nonetheless, just so that we can, you know, have it out there for people who to hear this. Yes.
Quick thing, you got a 703 on the line. After your clip, bring 703 on. That's Rex.
Okay, great. I will. Thank you very much, Dan.
No problem.
You see, United Nations proposal to create a series of centralized planning provisions where all of a sudden your local city government can't do something because of some agreement they signed with some private group who are all committed basically to taking control of your private property and turning it into a publicly controlled property. And I think everywhere I go in the country today, people, are, particularly the Tea Parties, are very worried about Agenda 21. It's part of a general problem of the United Nations and other international bureaucracies that are seeking to create an extra constitutional control over us, and I reject that model totally. The United States is a sovereign country. The United Nations does not authorize anything to the United States, and the United Nations does not have any control over the United States, and we want to make sure that that remains our core value as we go forward.
Okay, but this time I'll go ahead and bring Rex in.
Hello,
Rex.
Hello.
Thank you for calling in.
Hey, Robert. How are you?
I'm
Arlen,
good.
Dan. Nice to
have
you guys on.
Good.
Hey, Rex.
Hey, Dan. Hey, Arlen. I've been reading your website for a long time, and I got to tell everybody who's listening. You know, Arlen is spot on. I mean, he is giving clear analysis backed up by a lot of data about exactly the fight that we're in, which, you know, in a microcosm right now is about a brokered convention because Mitt and Obama are the same. But in the macro, it comes down to that age-old battle, and that is between the oligarchs that want to rule us and the people who have been given sovereignty by God that only we can give away by being apathetic, lazy, and easily manipulated. So I think listening to what Arlen has to say really can help you wake up.
Excellent. Well, I've certainly been enjoying it, Rex, and you got in touch with me and said that he was going to be on. So I was like, okay, well, you know, Rex says he's good people. I'll dial in. Now, I've been to Gulag Planet several times over the past few years, but never more than, you know, like someone linking an article or something. And so, you know, I've read several things that were there, but now I'm kind of more keyed into it.
So, yeah, Arlen, there's a person in the chat who put the letters I-C-L-E-I. Now, they look familiar, but could you, you know, clarify that for me? I've seen that before, that anagram before.
Well, I think maybe we lost Arlen.
I'm sorry?
Did we lose Arlen?
Might have. No, it's. Let me check. I don't know if he's having any problems on the line.
I think it was you, Rex.
I said it? Or I got rid of him?
No, I think you might have scared him.
I'm sorry.
I'll check another line.
Isn't it something like an International Coalition of Sustainable Local Government or some garbage like that?
Hold on a second. Is this Arlen? I'm opening up the other line.
I'm sorry. I'm here now.
Oh, okay. Then I'll try this line. Are you still there?
Yeah, I apologize
profusely.
Okay, great.
No, that's quite all right, Arlen. Go ahead.
I-C-L-E-I. is, International Association of Local Government. No, wait a minute. Yeah, that's tough. Let's see.
Statists love their acronyms, don't they?
Oh, my gosh. Acronyms and abstractions. And terms, they play the game. Okay, International Council for Local Environmental Initiatives. And we would be remiss if we didn't treat that and how Agenda 21 is implemented. So let me try to do that real fast.
Mm-hmm.
They
go ahead. I think it'd be a good segue in what I'd like to discuss next. Go ahead.
Okay. They play up. They get into a community and they sell this program. It's like a traveling salesperson. They pull out the kit and demonstrate how. And they'll literally pull things out of their briefcase and show the city planners and the city council members how it all works so that government and private enterprise and people and civic organizations can all get together and make sure that we have a sustainable economy so that government can help everybody just get along for generations and not damage the environment that's in such jeopardy. And then everybody says, oh, yeah, we can do that. Well, no, actually they don't, because a lot of times they get into situations where people complain. And what they do is exactly what Saul Alinsky would do with some of his internal or initial organizing, community organizing meetings. I participated in that kind of a meeting when I was 23, was brought into one and became involved in a Alinsky style operation that was actually doing a couple good things, and then I left them. They hold what's called the kind of a perverted method of the Delphi method of bringing groups to predetermined objectives, and there is a kind of a semi-legitimate research method called the Delphi method. This is kind of the bastardized psyops version of that. And what they do is they get people. They lead facilitated meetings, break it down into little groups where everybody expresses their opinion, and then of course the teacher teaches of what they really should be talking about. And in the course of finding out who disagrees with them, they manipulate the rest so that those people that disagree are marginalized and essentially ridiculed and drummed out of the work. Oh, okay. And why don't you describe that? But then the next step it goes is to selling that, and the council votes for it, and then they, lo and behold, they're implementing all these myriad regulations that will tell you that you cannot farm that particular part of land because water sits on it for a few months of the year or a few weeks of the year, and so it's a wetland, so you can't farm that anymore. Well, by the way, you've got a house along the river, and you can live there, but you can't sell it to anybody but government, or all sorts of increased, built-up regulations that are meant to be the initial way to drive people off the land and make it impossible for them to sell their houses and impossible for them to farm. And lo and behold, in California, we have the irrigation disasters. We also have one going on in Texas, where people can't irrigate because of whatever concocted excuse exists, some little fish or some little maggoty animal. And so that's how that's done. It's all that kind of cock and bull and here again, public private partnerships. It's extra governmental, paragovernmental. It's exactly orchestrated, and people are told what to do out of Agenda 21. And then there are documented and videoed confrontations in some of these city councils, and we have one on Gulag Bound, where people confront the city council about this, and then they're ridiculed, same way, as being crazy, because you're talking about these communists and fascists. Those are the people that put Jews in ovens. What are you talking about, you crazy dude? And so those people get ridiculed out of the meeting, and they just keep on going with it. What was your story? Was it Dan or Rex?
Yeah. Well, this is Dan. You know, part of the story, not for public airing, but, you know, I tell you in private. But, you know, I sort of came out and I was just like, look, you know, I'd worked there for a long time. And then my DOE was created in 1977, term of bureaucratic service is 30 years, which means in 2007, everybody essentially retires unless they get early retirement. So there was some early retirement going on. And the director of my office and his assistant director, they retired essentially on the same day. They made the assistant director stay for an extra month. But what that left was me in charge. Okay, so I said, all right, well, this office has some problems, and these are the ways that we can fix these problems. And we can create more transparency, more understanding. We can manage the office much better if we do the following things, right? And at the same time, about 3 months earlier, I had launched my whole broadside against climate change in the form of a PowerPoint. So I was the most popular guy in the world. And so, you know, the thing became, Dan is insane. You know, he's crazy. Everything he's talking about, he's out of his mind. You know, all this kind of stuff to marginalize you, ridicule you, make you think less of yourself. But, you know, I'm not telling you there weren't some hard days there. Believe me, there are some really, really hard days, you know, probably the hardest days of my life, but I came through it. And at the end of it, I thought, this is a multi-billion-dollar-a-year agency. The DOE is $24 billion a year. Okay, I'm one guy. It's not like I had a whole bevy of friends who were on my side. It was just me standing up and speaking the truth. And so that $24 billion-a-year organization just focused its efforts on destroying me. And at the end of the day, I withstood everything that they had to fire against me because I had documented sources. I could prove everything. And, you know, they lost. A lot of people lost their jobs over it. But it's not fun. And what you're saying is absolutely the truth. But the thing is, look, we're going through this. If you want to get this country back, you got to be able to walk through fire and not care. You know, and I'm not talking fire, I'm talking lava. You just go right through the lava and you don't care because there's no other choice.
Can you hear me?
Yeah, I'll put you in on the other line, Arlen.
Yeah, my computer did fail for the communications. I am sorry, but so I'll be eager to hear that. story when I can check out the archive.
Yeah.
No. Go ahead. I don't want to interrupt you. I just wanted to bring to a point where, you know, earlier this evening we were talking about how through Agenda 21 it's a top-down approach, you know, towards environmental protection, and it's not really about environmental protection. That's the story that they try to give, you know. But the way, I mean, as I said, is that I am an environmentalist, and I do believe that, you know, we do need to protect the environment. I do believe we have to, you know, conserve our resources, and we have to do things in a sustainable way. You know, we still need to, you know, I'm definitely not a, you know, supporter of, you know, a lot of what the liberals do, such as, you know, the population control. I'm adamantly against, you know, anything like that. But we still do need to have solutions. And since it's not going to come from the top down in order to address the issues of environmental protection, conservation, and sustainability. And we have to do it, in my opinion, from the ground up. Now, you know, I call the show Green Conservatism. It's not my phrase. I'm not the one who coined it. Newt Gingrich did. And for the people who might not have heard of what Green Conservatism is or, you know, want some clarification of that, I've got Newt himself, not him personally. I wish. That'd be awesome. But I've got a little clip here I'd like to play in order to, you know, give a flavor of what Green Conservative is. And what I'd like to do after the clip, I'm going to bring Samuel Samford in, who's on the line, because I'm sure he'd like to talk to everyone. But I'd also like to hear Arlen and Dan and Rex's opinion. And what ways do you guys think that we can move forward in order to protect the environment, conserve our resources, and live in a sustainable way that we can do, you know, through the prism of conservatism and it be from the grounds up?
Well,
Fora TV, the world is thinking.
And so the first message, which I've spent a lot of time the last few days on conservative talk radio, to the shock of some of my radio hosts, has been, you know, you can be a solid conservative and love the environment. You can care passionately about conservation. I remind Republicans routinely that Theodore Roosevelt created the National Forest Program. That Gifford Pinchot was a tremendous leader at the Department of the Interior. That it's in fact possible to have a very aggressive program that is oriented towards a better future and a better environment. But that to do that, you've got to look past any particular argument over ideology and start with core values and then work towards what we would describe as a market-oriented, science and technology-oriented, innovation-oriented, and entrepreneurial approach. The second conversation is with friends on the left who really love the environment but have come to describe the solutions in a fairly limited way of higher taxes, more regulation, more litigation, bigger government. Because I think there are potential breakthroughs. And many years ago, I read a book by Watzlawick et al. Called Problem Resolution, Problem Perception, Problem Resolution. They were California psychologists writing in the early 60s in response to the Freudian model. And their question was the following. If you come to see me and I just make you better, do you really care why you got sick? Or are you happy just being better? So let's say you suffer from claustrophobia and you have two strategies. One is to listen a long time and I'll eventually try to find out why when you were 4 years old your uncle locked you in the closet and ever since you've been claustrophobic so you can start to unlock being claustrophobic. The other is I can teach you four things to do and you'll quit being claustrophobic. Now if you just quit being claustrophobic, would you like to forget that topic and go on to a new one? And in a sense, what we're trying to develop is the following assertion. We are at the beginning of a cycle of scientific change so profound that there will be 4 to 7 times as much new science in the next 25 years as there was in the last 25 years. I think these are real numbers. Now, if there's going to be that much scientific change, if you're trying to design a project at the national level for the next 25 years, which is a reasonable length of time, my two grandchildren will be 31 and 33, so this is not forever. In that context, if it's 4 times as much change, a planning committee trying to understand what's going on would resemble a group in 1880 trying to understand this evening. Now, 1880 is pre-electric light, pre-automobile, pre-airplane, pre-long-distance telephone, pre-motion picture, pre-radio, pre-television. And to go and see somebody in 1880 and try to explain to them how you got here tonight, how you use a BlackBerry or a cell phone or how you use a car would be a daunting challenge. If there's 7 times as much new knowledge, then it's as though we were in 1660 with Sir Isaac Newton trying to discover calculus. Now, why does this matter if you care about the environment? Because it is very likely that a system which focuses on incentives, prizes, entrepreneurship, creativity, market effects, can accelerate the development of new solutions so dramatically that 10 or 15 years from now we're in a different world.
Here's new.
Great clip.
Very interesting. He always challenges people.
Yeah, Robert, sometimes Robert hits the back button and he loses the show, so he may be dialing back in.
Okay.
There I am.
Okay, there you go. Yeah, you hit the
there
back button.
There I am. Yeah, well, what it is I went to get a drink of water during the clip, and I put my phone on mute so you guys didn't have to hear my wife blow drying her hair. So I opened up the door. So, no, but before I people chime in on that, I want to bring in Samuel Samford, who also has a blog talk radio called Constitutional Conservatives Unite, and you can also find his show on Blog Talk Radio as well as on Newt Now, which to get there on Newt Now, you just go to the top of the Facebook page in the search engine, put in Newt Now as one word, N-E-W-T-N-O-W, and you will see a list of shows with Sammy on it. And as I said, you can also find him on Blog Talk Radio, Political Conservative. Without any further ado, I'll let Sammy in, and then like that opens the lines for people to comment on what they heard about green conservatism.
Hey.
Hello, Sammy. How's it going, buddy?
Hey, Robert. Doing good. I enjoyed that clip. That was awesome.
Great. Well, thank you for coming in, and if you want to chime in, and then if Arlen could chime in, because these are our guests tonight, so I'd like to go ahead and do it in that manner, and then people can jump in from there.
Okay, I heard
hey,
a little
Sandy,
bit about what
you
Oh, we're doing good, Rex. I had an awesome day today. Got to go meet Mr. Gingrich, and he gave an awesome speech. And I will go into more on my show. Let me just throw one thing in there. Then I'm going to let Robert have back the microphone. I just wanted to say he spoke for about 30 minutes today here in Jacksonville. And only twice he barely mentioned Mitt Romney. The rest of the time it was all about Barack Obama. And during his speech, he never once said he endorsed Mitt Romney. And I thought that was awesome. And Cindy Todd and I got to meet him, and my little granddaughter Jasmine, and we had an awesome time. But Robert, I'm going to let you have that tonight, because I know you have limited time. I'll expand on it more on my show at 10 o'clock, and I'm sure Cindy Todd will too, and we'll go into a lot more detail about it.
Great, Sammy. I'll be in there later on this evening. Yes, sir.
All righty. Well, here, I'm going to let y'all go because my show cranks up in 25 minutes, and I need to get ready for it.
All right, Sammy. And take care.
Keep up the great work, Robert.
In. Thank you, Sammy. Appreciate it.
You're welcome.
Bye. Okay, folks, as I said, that's Samuel Sanford. You guys are in Blog Talk Radio Show, which will be on in approximately 25 minutes. I suggest going on there, especially if you're one who likes the idea of a broker convention. I'm sure we'll be talking about that. He's definitely and obviously a Newt Gingrich fan, and if you are a Newt Gingrich fan, I recommend going there and joining us. I'll be in there later on this evening, probably around 11 p.m. Eastern time. But I'm going to give up the floor once again to Arlen Williams. Go ahead, Arlen.
Well, shucks. Newt Gingrich is like, you know, if you got like trench warfare with one bunch lined up and shooting the other bunch and they're all in their trenches, Newt is the guy that gets up and walks between the trenches and say, hey, have you tried this other way?
Right.
And God bless him that people were really able to use that to really cut into him, like Glenn Beck and Ann Coulter and so many others. And they were really finding things in Newt's past where I think he's actually repented of, but he still carries forward an activist mentality where it's certainly not libertarian, and he likes to figure out how government can help people to be free and prosperous. Okay, so he hasn't given that up, and rightfully so. I mean, like we're always saying, the nation was founded from the point of view that government, federal government, should be grossly limited, but in the hustings, people had that laboratory where they could figure out how government should address shared needs. And he sure goes there. I think government has to set a tone, has to set a flavor, a policy, and certainly the environmental, stewardship over the environment is a fundamental requirement for government involvement to a degree, but I don't know enough about, even from hearing Newt and that presentation, I would have to read the book and dissect it. I think I might have tempted Mark Musser in chatting the last couple of days, so he might read that book that he wrote with the co-author and the subject matter expert.
Jerry Maple.
But,
mm-hmm.
Yeah, maybe you can tell me, give me a couple of examples of what he's talking about in practical solutions, and then we can best judge whether it's a good thing or a bad thing.
Great, and I have one such example is, he talks about new technologies and new ways to approach, how things have been done, kind of changing a paradigm, so to speak, is that I had the opportunity to speak to a gentleman. I'm hoping he can, you know, come on the show one time and talk about his business. And what his business is called subsoil pressurized irrigation. Subsoil pressurized irrigation. And it's out in California. And environmentally, two of the main crux of it is, one, it's to conserve water, water conservation. And two, it protects the environment through focusing both water and fertilizer to the roots of, you know, whatever your, you know, your tree or garden. And it's environmentally friendly in the ways that, one, when you have above-ground irrigation, you need to use 80% more. I mean, this cuts, you know, subsoil irrigation cuts water usage by 80%. So you're saving, you know, 80% of the water you normally would be. You're only using 20% of the water because the water goes straight to, you know, the root zone in which the tree, you know, or the plants, or the, you know, whatever, in a garden, let's say, or a crop, you know, gets the water. Now, one, that conserves, you know, water. Two is you're not going to have runoff. You're not going to have as much runoff. And a lot of ways people do with crops and even lawns is what they do is they put the fertilizers on the surface. Okay. Now, if you live in an area like, the suburbs where, you know, the water runs off your lawn, and in some of these they have like a creek. Well, the fertilizers will actually run off the top of the, you know, of the lawns, you know, or even the crops and go into the creeks and contaminate them with, you know, chemicals that otherwise they wouldn't have not gotten them by nature, and it pollutes them that way. But if you are injecting the chemicals at the subsoil level into the root zone, then those, you know, the chemicals that the, and the fertilizer that the plants need, you know, gets absorbed to the roots. Now, the way you save money that way is, one, you're not waste. You're saving money through waste, but also through crops and trees like orchards. What that does is it increases the yield. And the reason it increases the yield is because the plants, such as the tree or corn or what have you, is it's not spending as much of its energy creating a larger root system to get these nutrients and get the water, and so it bears more fruit, so to speak, or you know, more of the crop you're looking for, because it can expend its more of its energy. The plant can spend more of its energy creating, you know, the fruit, so to, you know, if it's from a tree, instead of building a more expansive or extensive root system. And so that would be something where I would consider a green technology.
What does he want to do about it? If I may ask and interject, what needs to be done there to give people license to cooperate and do that and form their own method to discipline how it gets done? Or does it need government supervision to implement? If so, does it need to be taxpayer funded?
One thing that's gone horribly wrong is. You've seen businesses such as Solyndra that have gotten, you know, tax dollars, and they went under. Well, they gave – see, what Newt Gingrich is for, it prizes and, you know, tax incentives for businesses such as I described, okay? But the problem that we've seen in that – and I'm not saying it's the method itself is problematic. I'm saying is where those funds are, you know, put to is where the problem came in. I mean, I don't have a problem – I never had a problem with Obama's giving the money to a green technology group. My problem is the company he was giving the money for had a bad business model, and they were going to fail, and they've been warned that they were going to fail, and so the taxpayers had to, you know, foot the bill, so to speak, because, you know, basically it was cronyism, you know, and that's something you touched earlier. With crony capitalism. So I'm not suggesting crony capitalism by any, any stretch, but there is tax incentives that you can. I mean, the oil industry has been subsidized by the government for a long time, you know. But what I would suggest, See, what the government is, I think, what, and I can't speak for
Neil.
That's not really true. Giving someone a tax break is not a subsidy.
Well, I'm not saying the arm. What I mean by subsidies, and I'm talking about tax breaks, all I'm saying is government involvement in general is what I'm talking about. Yeah, I'm just talking in generalities with government involvement. With a business is what I'm saying, with an industry.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's a tricky proposition because that's where corporatism always comes in. I mean, the simple fact is, if you want a clean environment, you know, the best tool for a clean environment is private property. I mean, just look at the bathroom of the restaurant you went out to dinner Friday night, and look at the bathroom that you stopped at on the side of the road at a government-owned rest stop. Which one was clean and which one was disgusting? You know, public property is never taken care of. So when government is going to take care of something, you will get the lowest common denominator to sort of steward it. When it's private property and it's yours and it's held dear, you will steward it better. Now, that doesn't mean government doesn't have a role. Obviously, you need the government to help where there are no other mediating institutions to settle disputes between private property owners, but the fundamental problem is when government takes over something, it will never be a good steward because government is about power, and it is only going to seek the end of what is the most powerful and expedient, especially in a government like ours, where those in power lose their jobs every 2, 6, 4 years. They have no incentive for long-term stewardship because they're not going to be there. So I think the issue is that we need more private property, and government's role is merely to act as a mediating institution where there are no other mediating institutions. For example, if you have a local cooperative of farmers, you don't need government because the cooperative structure will take care of mediating the problems. Government only needs to come in where those natural community mediating institutions don't exist, and the best way to foster more of those is more private property. Of course, it's hard to have private property when every one of us has to pay rent to own property to the government.
Well, Robert's example is just a fascinating one. So let's pick a case hypothetically where there is a stretch of where there's an aquifer or a nice healthy river or something, and there are like 6 farms in a row or ranches that can be fed subsoil from that, and they get together in their own little meetings and decide if they want to do it. It's a great idea. 5 of them decide that would be tremendous. We can hire more people. We can produce more, feed the world better, and make more money and get our families in a better situation. And one says, no, I don't want to do that because I want to do something else. I want to, have my pristine land here and don't want to have anything to do with your underground pipe going through my land. So what do you do in a case like that? Do you make the guy give up his underlayment of earth to get that done and disrupt his land to lay pipe? Well, that's often where with railroads and highways and very many other things, eminent domain comes into play where government latches onto something and says, yeah, we want to do this.
Well, you know, this is a big issue down in Texas right now because we have the Eagle Ford Shale, and the problem with the Eagle Ford Shale is we're producing all this natural gas and all this natural gas liquids or gas condensate, and gas condensate, you got to get it to the refineries. Okay, well, the Eagle Ford Shale stretches, you know, basically from South Texas, you know, following kind of the Gulf Coast up to essentially Bryan College Station, right? So you have all these liquids, but there's no pipelines for them. So you've got to build the pipelines to get them to the refineries. And so there's this big fight between ranchers and, you know, the oil companies. Now, of course, in the U.S., if you have land and they discover oil on your land, you're jumping up for joy because you're rich, right? If you're in France and they discover oil on your land, you're screaming at the heavens because it's a national oil company, you don't get any money. The problem comes in midstream when you're building the pipeline because the people who are having the pipeline built across their property, they're not actually getting anything. I mean, they cut them into these master limited partnerships and that kind of stuff. They negotiate properly. But at a certain point, what you raise about highways and railroads and all that kind of stuff, there is a national interest in allowing that stuff to go through. So, you know, my thing would be to find the people who are like-minded individuals who want to partake of a slice of the pie and route it that way. You know, of course, that sometimes would be more expensive. And then in certain extreme cases, you just, you know, you have to apply the power of the state, which is why the power of the state needs to be limited. But you have to apply the power of the state to allow that to go through because, you know, the price of everything is determined by gasoline prices, oil prices, natural gas prices, and they have to reach market. You know, compensate the person, but, you know, it's like electricity, right? Okay, so in Germany, they said, hey, we want more wind, right? So Germany's like, all right, we're going to build all this stupid wind that makes zero economic sense. And so where does Germany have wind? Well, they have it up in the Alps. So they built a bunch of wind up in the Alps. Problem? Nobody lives in the Alps. They all live, you know, on the Rhine Valley. So then they had to build power lines to get the electricity that people wanted. They wanted the wind, and then they wanted to get the electricity to the grid. Well, okay, the grid is, you know, thousands of miles away over on the Rhine River. And so they had to build power lines. And then people didn't want to allow the power lines to be built. You know, so what do you do?
But the scale I was speaking of in my example is that, and where government would maybe pay a part of that is too, if the gentleman who has this business or lady who has this business or group who has this business, you know, created the business themselves. I mean, they created the technology of, you know, of subsurface, you know, pressurized irrigation. And one way that, you know, I'm saying where the government could have had involvement is in two ways. One of which they could have been given if they come up with this technology, it's been proven to work, they have a prototype, what they could do is set up where there could be rewards in the form of grants, you know, in order, because, you know, they're not continually getting pumped money from the government, but say, okay, we have this fund for a grant for if they have a proven technology that could be used to protect the environment, it's just this set of money for them to do to actually build this product. Or they could give some kind of, you know, tax incentive for, you know, for the same thing. But what I'm saying is this is a business. What I'm saying is that businesses such as the, you know, subsoil pressurized irrigation can pop up all over the place where that can become the new way of irrigating. I'm not saying that, you know, some massive, like, covering all these farms. Now, if each individual farm decided, hey, you know what, it's more cost effective. I mean, it's great that it's environmentally, you know, sound, but it's also a win-win situation. It's not only environmentally sound. We're going to get a larger crop, so we're going to have more food to sell. We're going to have lower water bills because we're going to be using less water. So it's a win-win situation. And if farmer, you know, B sees, farmer A is having so much success because, you know, they have this environmentally friendly way of irrigating that also saves them money and increases their yield. Well, wow, that's great. Maybe I should go do what, you know, farmer B is doing. They adopt what farmer A is doing. And then it just continues down a line where now you have an industry in which, you know, people start creating, you know, all of these. And then the guy who created it, you know, he's got a patent, so he's going to make money. He's going to get rich. But other, you know, from creating the technology to do this. And so that's kind of the example that I was alluding to when I was, you know, talking about the subsurface pressurized irrigation and how the government could, you know, what little involvement they would have in that process.
Well, there wouldn't be much involvement there at all because of the simple fact that once one farmer does it, then he's going to be able to outcompete the other farmers. They either get on board or he will just grow and destroy them. I mean, that's the beautiful thing about the market.
It's the environment, right.
Exactly. And the fact is that, look, if you're a small business owner or a small family farmer, as opposed to a large agribusiness or a large corporation that is managed by bean counters who got their Harvard MBAs from thousands of miles away and are disinterested, you have a vested interest in conserving the environment because that is the only thing that's going to yield future profits, whereby, you know, corporate raiders in the mold of, say, Mitt Romney come in and they gut something for short-term profits with no desire to even look at long-term consequences. Now, you know, does government have a role in preventing that from happening? I don't think so. I think the market can do that. Government has a role in not fostering that kind of behavior, which is what it's going on right now. But the idea that, you know, like if there's an aquifer or something that one farmer has on his land and downriver that the other guys could easily be deprived if the farmer dams it up, well, then there you might need government intervention because he may have a right to that parcel of land, but he has no right to prevent the water from flowing down to the other farms.
Yeah, Wyoming, right. I took a look into this just a few months ago, and Wyoming has a very complex set of rules now that's you know, kind of unusual for the free right-wing state that it is, that if you irrigate water from a river in a new irrigation, then you have to give that water back, almost all of it. You know, it gets ridiculous, and so it gets a little onerous. But
gentlemen,
there has to be
I don't mean to interrupt, but I've only have maybe 6 minutes left, and I do have someone who's on hold, so I'd like to let them come in and chime in if they may, if you don't mind, because we only have a few minutes left, I'd like to get a little bit of time in. So, and then you guys can go ahead. Hello, 914.
Hi, Robert.
Oh, hi, Lisa. How are you?
Good. How are you?
I'm good, but I'm going to be quiet now for the next couple of minutes so that you can you can speak with Arlen, Dan, and Rex. So go ahead, Bea. Go ahead, guys.
Hi, Arlen, Dan, and Rex.
Hello. Hey, Lisa. How's it going?
Good. Hi, Arlen. You're terrific. It's a pleasure to hear you on the radio blog.
Well, thank you, and let's talk tomorrow.
Okay.
With our project at SouthChem.
I actually just called in. I missed a lot of it, so I don't. I'm gonna sit back and listen. My computer keeps freezing up, so I couldn't. I had to call in to be able to hear.
So, I understand. But, you know, I work on this on my wife's computer, and it's a dinosaur. So, you know, hey, maybe after a while I could turn it to some oil and help.
Well, I'm using a dinosaur right now because my computer's in repair. My regular computer.
Okay.
So this is I'm using an archaic computer that freezes if I open a new window or type into the chat. So
I understand. Okay, well, I'll go ahead and put you back on hold then, or I can keep the line open, whichever.
Okay, I'll mute myself, and that way if I want to contribute,
okay.
I can.
Okay, great. That sounds like a great idea.
Okay,
I do only have, even says 4 minutes left, so while I can, I would like to... thank you, Arlen, for coming in tonight. I'm hoping that we can continue this conversation, at another time and have you on your show, because one thing I have learned about Agenda 21, it can definitely not can be investigated fully in a 1-2 hour show or an hour and a half, or hour and 50 minutes that we've covered it. So hopefully, you'll give me the opportunity again for you to come on and discuss it further.
My privilege and pleasure. Let me just say one more time that I really would like to direct people's attention to the Sovereignty Campaign, SOVCAM.org, and we're going to be developing that a lot in the next few weeks and months and getting you information on candidates as to whether or not they're going to be for or against Agenda 21, the International Criminal Court, Small Arms Treaty, and these other violations of national and popular and state sovereignty, and we're going to try to put the focus back on where it should be as the core of our Western civilization.
Great. Thank you very much. Dan or Rex, if you're still there, if you'd like to add something in, as I said, I got about 2.5 minutes left. So
maybe a concluding thought. I wrote a few things down, but the thing Newt Gingrich is saying, and I agree with this, you can't concede the environment to the left. The left takes all these things like mom and apple pie, and they wrap themselves in it and say that they actually support it. When they don't, they're trying to kill it. For instance, I was reading something very recently that was very interesting on the concept of selfishness, right? So the left says that the people on the right and libertarians are selfish, and they're selfish because they want to keep the things that they earned on their own, right? And that if they weren't selfish, they would give it all to everybody else who didn't have anything to do with it. That's nonsense, because the left is selfish because they see what somebody else has and they want it and they go legislate it so that they can have it. That is selfishness, to look at somebody else's property and say, I want that, and compel them to give it up. They have redefined selfishness. And on the environment issue, if you look at, whether or not you believe mankind is causing this thing or not, the Stern Report came out of the UK and it said, we have to look at mitigation strategies, because you can't give a government department enough money that they could lower the temperature of the planet. That just doesn't happen. And the Stern Report estimated that the amount of money needed to lower the planet's temperature by 1 degree Celsius was something like $50 trillion, in which case, forget it. That's not going to happen. It's just complete, utter nonsense. And what Newt Gingrich was doing with Nancy Pelosi was saying we need private sector innovation to come up with innovative solutions. And if you watch that commercial, I encourage everyone to go watch it, that's all he says. He literally says all of 13 words. You know, write your congressman and say that we need innovation. Now, he didn't say private sector because Nancy wouldn't have sat down with him if he did. But that's what he meant. So we can't concede that fight to them. We have to have a place at the table because if you don't, you're on the menu.
Okay, and then I've got like 30 seconds. You there, Rex? You got maybe 20 seconds to make a comment? Or?
real quick, I would just say that this is an important issue, and no, we do not need to cede the environment to the left. The fact is that, you know, when someone earns what they earn and it's their property, that doesn't mean that they keep it in a greedy way. You have the right to give it away, but no one else has the right to make you give it away.
Mm-hmm. And there we have it. Well, thank you, everyone. This is going to just shut off in 10 seconds, so everyone take care. I look forward to speaking with you again. Have a good night, and